Hello and welcome to another episode of California Crime Stories. This podcast is brought to you by a mom and daughter podcasting duo. I'm the daughter.
And I'm the mom.
And here we bring you true tales of murder and mystery from the Golden State. Some are old, some are new, some made national news, and some were small town stories. But all of them have piqued our interest over the years, and we know that they'll pique yours too. Maybe you joined us last episode for our deep dive into the disappearance and death of the Yuba County Five. Today, we'll be leaving Yuba County and the rugged, snowy terrain of Plumas National Forest behind and heading to slightly warmer and sunnier climates. We'll be traveling several hundred miles south through the Central Valley and traveling several decades forward in time to Los Angeles in December of 2000 to discuss the murder of Susan Berman.
On Christmas Eve of 2000, Los Angeles police were called to the home of journalist and author Susan Berman. Susan's neighbors had become worried when they noticed that her back door was open and that her dogs were running loose in their Benedict Canyon neighborhood. Inside the home, police found the body of 55-year-old Berman, who had been killed by a single bullet wound to the back of the head. Police initially suspected that Susan Berman, the daughter of Las Vegas mob boss Davey Berman, had been the victim of a hit. But the case went cold, and it wasn't until 15 years later that police arrested and charged the first suspect in her murder, Susan's longtime friend, Robert Durst. You may have heard Susan or Robert's name if you've seen the HBO documentary series The Jinx, which recounts the life of real estate heir Robert Durst and the string of alleged murder victims that he left in his wake across several states and several decades. As of March 2020, Durst is on trial in Los Angeles for Susan Berman's murder. Durst will be an important player in today's story. He was one of Susan Berman's closest friends and confidants, and as you'll see later, their lives and stories converge in several critical moments. But we won't be telling the Robert Durst story today. If that's what you're looking for, we highly recommend you watch The Jinx. Instead, we'll be telling the Susan Berman story, because we fear that Susan's story is at risk of being overshadowed, even in her own murder trial, by Robert Durst's larger-than-life personality, and also by COVID-19, which has placed the trial on hiatus until April of 2021. We'll be telling the Susan Berman story because Susan was herself larger than life. She was a mobster's daughter, a gifted storyteller, a survivor in spite of personal, professional, and financial struggles, a loving mother, and a fiercely loyal friend.
In researching the life and death of Susan Berman, we drew from Susan's autobiography, Easy Street, from Kathy Scott's book, Murder of a Mafia Daughter, The Life and Tragic Death of Susan Berman, from the HBO documentary series, The Jinx, and from the podcast, Jury Duty, The Trial of Robert Durst. We also drew from several articles about Susan Berman and Robert Durst published in New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, The New York Times, The LA Times, Las Vegas City Life, and the Nevada Historical Society Quarterly. Susan Berman also appeared in episode number 76 of This American Life, titled Mob. In it, she reads a brief excerpt from her autobiography and talks about her discovery that her father was in the mob. It's a treat to hear Susan tell her own story, and hearing her voice made us feel a little closer to her as we researched this story. You can find the links to that episode and all of our sources in the show notes.
Susan Berman was born in Minneapolis in 1945. Susan's mother, Gladys, was a tap dancer, and Susan's father, Davy, was a prominent member of the Jewish mob. The year after Susan was born, the family moved to Las Vegas, where Susan would spend most of her childhood. Susan's father, Davy, became part owner and manager of several Vegas hotels, the El Cortez, the Las Vegas Club, the El Dorado, the Flamingo, and the Riviera. At that time, Las Vegas wasn't the city we know today. David Berman would be one of the founders of modern-day Sin City. Susan's childhood in Las Vegas and her father's connections with the mob would really become the cornerstone of her identity and would influence much of her writing. So we're going to spend a little time in Vegas setting the scene for the rest of Susan's life before we move on.
Las Vegas was a small and sleepy town when famed mobster Bugsy Siegel first rolled in to spark a wave of casino and hotel construction which would eventually become the Strip. Bugsy's joint, the Flamingo, was high class, for sophisticated high rollers. It opened in 1946, but had yet to turn a profit before Bugsy himself was executed gangland style in Los Angeles in June 1947. Davy Berman and his partners were then called in to take control of the Flamingo, which within 6 months was a moneymaker. This success made Davy a well-respected hotel and casino mogul, and one of the foremost members of the Jewish mob in Las Vegas. Davy was also an extremely devoted husband and father, and he loved having his daughter by his side. He managed to both spoil her and shelter her from the darker elements of his professional life. In many ways, Susan lived a charmed childhood. She spent her days doing cannonballs in the Flamingo Hotel pool, riding horses, ordering room service, and doing her homework in the casino counting room. She played dress-up backstage with the showgirls' costumes. She learned how to do math on an old slot machine given to her by her father. Elvis and Liberace sang at her birthday parties.
But beneath the glamorous facade, the Bermans lived under constant threat of violence. While her husband worked 14-hour days, Gladys Berman raised her daughters surrounded by bodyguards in a home whose windows had been raised to deter hitmen. When mob unrest in Las Vegas threatened the family's safety, Davy would take his daughter to Los Angeles on what he called vacations. Young Susan was drilled on what to do if she were ever kidnapped. Meanwhile, the constant worry that her daughter or husband would be hurt wreaked havoc on Gladys Berman's mental health. Since the family's arrival in Las Vegas, Gladys had suffered with anxiety and depression. Gladys was away for much of Susan's childhood, seeking treatment. She underwent both electroshock therapy and a hysterectomy, which were common treatments for depression at the time. When she was home, Gladys was often bedridden, sad, and seemingly lost in her dark thoughts.
When Gladys moved to Los Angeles to undergo further treatment for her anxiety and depression, Davy told his wife that he and Susan would soon join her there. Davy was tired of the Vegas life. He didn't think it was the right environment for his Susan to grow up in, and he felt far from his wife. He sensed that he was losing her for good. Davy had risen up the mob ladder, but at what cost? His success in Vegas had destroyed his wife and put his daughter in danger. So Davy wanted out, but he knew that the mob would never let him leave. As this reality set in, Davy grew increasingly depressed and disconnected, even from Susan. Sin City had become a prison for Davy, just as it had for Gladys. And Davy Berman would never leave Las Vegas. On Father's Day, 1957, he died unexpectedly of heart failure during a routine abdominal surgery. He was 53 years old, and Susan was only 12. His funeral was reported to be one of the largest Las Vegas had ever seen. Mourners referred to him as Mr. Las Vegas, and as one of the town's original pioneers. Susan reportedly tried to throw herself into her father's casket. In young Susan's eyes, her father Davy had been the king of Las Vegas, and she his princess. She wouldn't find out that her father Davy Berman was a convicted criminal, gangster, bootlegger, bank robber, kidnapper, and killer until she was an adult.
By the time Davy died, Susan's mother was too sick to care for her, and she herself would die the following year. Throughout Susan's life, she dealt with a great deal of uncertainty about her mother's death. At the time, Susan was told that Gladys had died of a heart attack. Susan later found out that the coroner had ruled Gladys's death a suicide by overdose. But Susan and other family members later came to believe that her mother may have been murdered by mob members who were unwilling to pay out Davy Berman's shares in the hotel to Gladys. Now an orphan at just 13, Susan went to live with her father's brother, Chickie Berman, in Lewiston, Idaho. Uncle Chickie was a gambler and a bookkeeper. He sent Susan to an Episcopal boarding school in Portland, Oregon, where she graduated with honors. As her father had always hoped, Susan was the first Berman to attend college. It was in college, at UCLA, that Susan Berman first met Robert Durst.
Susan and Robert met at UCLA in the 1960s, while Susan was pursuing her bachelor's degree and Robert a graduate degree. The two bonded over their unconventional upbringings and over the fact that both had lost their mothers to suicide. Susan often referred to her friend Bobby as her brother. She set up some of her friends on blind dates with him. Later, when she achieved success as an author, she would always mention her friend Bobby in the dedications of her books. When Susan got married, Bobby walked her down the aisle.
Now, anyone who has watched The Jinx would likely surmise that Robert Durst is not an easy man to love, nor is he a very warm, loving person. Yet Susan really loved Bob, and the feeling appeared to be mutual. Throughout their lives, both Susan and Bob talked to other friends about how close the two were and how much each one cared about the other. Bob himself said that Susan had been his best friend during most of his life, and that she would do damn close to anything for him. Susan was fiercely loyal to Bobby, perhaps to a fault, as we'll see later.
Susan earned her bachelor's degree from UCLA in 1967, and then earned her master's in journalism from UC Berkeley in 1969. She wrote her first book only 2 years later, and went on to write for several California publications, publishing profiles on notable figures of the day, including Angela Davis and Jimmy Hoffa. She wrote for the San Francisco Examiner for several years, and for KPIX-TV in San Francisco, then spent a year living and writing in Israel, and then moved to New York to write for New York Magazine.
Robert Durst also moved to New York around this time, where he married a young dental assistant named Kathleen McCormick. They appeared to be a happy couple for several years, splitting time between a penthouse in Manhattan and a home outside the city. Kathy and Susan themselves became close friends. As the oldest son of the Durst family, Robert was heir apparent to the Durst real estate empire. The Durst organization owned and managed a number of Manhattan high-rises and still does to this day. As of 2020, the Durst organization controls over $8 billion worth of real estate in New York City, just to give you an idea of the world in which Robert Durst operated.
But back to Susan's life. In 1977, Susan decided to learn the whole truth about her father. She went back to Vegas and to her father's hometown in North Dakota and got a hold of his FBI file. This investigation became the basis for her book, Easy Street, which was published in 1981 to rave reviews. Universal Studios even bought the rights for $350,000, although the film would never be made. This was really the pinnacle of Susan's career. She'd had success as a journalist on both coasts, and she was hosting dinner parties and rubbing shoulders with other prestigious people in the New York literary world. Between her book, the deal with Universal, and the money she inherited from her father, Susan was living well at this time.
Her friend Robert Durst, on the other hand, was not doing well. His marriage to Kathy was failing. Kathy told friends that Robert was physically abusive on many occasions. Both Robert and Kathy were unfaithful. Robert had long controlled Kathy financially, giving her a modest monthly allowance and paying her medical school tuition. But Kathy was now in her last year of medical school and becoming increasingly independent. The more Kathy pulled away, the more she slipped from her husband's grip, the angrier Robert got. In the months before her death, Kathleen told multiple friends that if anything ever happened to her, they should suspect foul play, and they should suspect her husband, Robert Durst. All of this came to a head on Sunday, January 31st, 1982, when after leaving a party at a friend's house outside of the city, Kathleen disappeared, never to be seen again.
In the days after Kathleen's disappearance, police tried to put together a timeline of Kathleen's whereabouts, based on statements by Robert Durst and others who supposedly saw and spoke with Kathleen after the night of January 31st. According to Robert Durst, Kathleen went to the party at her friend's house on Sunday night, then returned to their residence in South Salem, 50 miles north of Manhattan. The two fought, and then Robert drove his wife to a nearby train station so she could take the train into the city. It was Sunday, after all. She had work in the morning. Robert reported that he spoke with Kathleen on the phone later that evening, by which time she was in bed at their Manhattan residence, watching television. He said that this was the last time he spoke to Kathleen. Both the superintendent and the doorman of the apartment building in Manhattan reported seeing Kathleen on that Sunday night. Now these two supposed sightings proved inconclusive, and Durst quickly changed his story regarding the phone call with Kathy. Had he called her from their home in South Salem, or from a payphone? Durst later admitted that he had never actually spoken to Kathleen on the phone after her trip into the city Sunday night.
But another person did allegedly have contact with Kathleen Durst after her supposed disappearance. On Monday morning, the assistant dean of Albert Einstein Medical College, where Kathleen was a student, received a phone call from someone purporting to be Kathleen Durst. The caller said that she wouldn't be coming into work that day because she was ill. Now this is where Susan Berman comes in. It has long been suspected that it was Susan who made that telephone call to the assistant dean of Albert Einstein, falsely identifying herself as Kathleen Durst. The assistant dean would later report that he hadn't ever interacted with the real Kathleen Durst for more than 5 or 10 minutes, and he couldn't say with any certainty whether it was Kathleen's voice he heard on the telephone. And why would Kathleen call the assistant dean of the medical school to say that she was feeling ill instead of calling her supervisor at the pediatric clinic where she had rotations that day? Could this phone call have been the work of someone who didn't know where Kathleen was supposed to be that Monday?
In the days following Kathleen Durst's disappearance, Bob enlisted Susan as his spokesperson. In that role, she basically fed information to newspapers that bolstered Robert's narrative of what happened. For example, newspaper articles at the time reported that the doorman of Kathy and Bob's apartment building had seen Kathy on the night of Sunday, January 31st, as we mentioned. But one of the NYPD officers who investigated Kathy's disappearance stated, when interviewed later for the Jinx, that law enforcement would not have released that detail to the media. Therefore, it had to have been the work of the Durst camp, whose media representative was Susan Berman. Susan was, of course, interviewed by police as a close friend of both Bobby and Kathy. She told them that Kathy had been using Quaaludes and that she was spending thousands of dollars on drugs. There's no evidence of that, and we know that Robert kept Kathy on such a short leash financially that she had to take out loans to pay for medical school. Susan would later tell multiple friends, in cryptic language, that she had in some way aided her friend Bobby after his wife Kathleen's disappearance. She told one friend that she provided Bob's alibi, and told another that, quote, Bobby asked me to do something, and I did it. She told another friend that she had made a phone call to Albert Einstein, pretending to be Kathy.
But the Kathleen Durst case went cold, and both Robert Durst and Susan Berman continued with their lives. Durst stayed in New York, working as always for the family business, while Susan moved to Los Angeles to pursue a career in screenwriting. As a child, Los Angeles had been Susan's safe haven. She hoped it would now bring her success. 2 months after arriving, Susan met the man who would become her husband, Mr. Margulies. His first name was actually Mr., by the way. At their wedding, Bobby Durst would give Susan away. Unfortunately, they divorced 6 months later when Susan discovered that Mr. was using drugs. Soon after their divorce, Mr. died of an overdose. His death sent Susan into the first of several breakdowns. A few years later, Susan started dating Paul Kaufman. Paul had a dream to produce a Broadway musical based on the Dreyfus affair, and Susan wanted to help him with it. They used Susan's savings to finance the project. Paul had two young children who Susan became very close to and would remain close to even after the Broadway project failed and Susan and Paul's relationship failed with it. To this day, Mella and Sarah Kaufman, Paul's children, consider Susan to be their mother. One of Susan's friends said that being a mother to Mella and Sarah was one of the proudest and most satisfying things in her life.
Drained of her savings, Susan struggled to make ends meet for the last 8 years of her life. She wrote a couple of mystery novels and worked on a television documentary about Las Vegas, and that kept her afloat for a little while. At the time of her death, she was working on several projects, including a sequel to Easy Street. And she was ever hopeful that one of these projects would be a success and that she would end up back in the black again. But she continued to live paycheck to paycheck, and when that wasn't enough, she sold her furniture and her mother's jewelry or borrowed money from friends. One such friend was Bobby Durst. In the summer of 2000, when Susan didn't have enough money to replace her 1984 Chrysler LeBaron, whose engine sometimes caught fire when she drove it, she reached out to Bobby for a loan. For months, Susan received no response. But suddenly, Bobby sent her a check for $25,000. He told her that it was not a loan, but a gift. In the months before her death, Susan would cash not one, but two $25,000 checks from Durst. And this small influx of cash allowed her to buy a new car and repay some of her other friends.
On December 19th, a few days before her murder, Susan spoke on the phone with her close friend Kim Lankford. Kim was packing a suitcase. This year she'd be spending Christmas on a cruise. She felt a bit guilty because she and Susan usually saw each other over the holidays, but Susan told her to not worry. After Christmas, the two would celebrate, and Susan might even have some exciting news to share. Susan told Kim that she had, quote, information that's going to blow the top off things. When Kim inquired further, Susan said that she didn't have the information herself yet, but she knew how to get it. They would talk more about it after the holidays. Kim told Susan to be careful. Later in the conversation, Susan mentioned that she had recently spoken with a psychic. This was not at all unusual for Susan. For over 15 years, she spoke regularly on the phone with a psychic in New York. But this was a new psychic based in Los Angeles. The psychic told Susan that she was going to die a violent death and that there would be a gun involved. On Friday, December 22nd, the night before her murder, Susan went to dinner and a movie with her friend Richard. They saw a dog show movie called Best in Show, which Susan apparently enjoyed, and over dinner, Susan talked about the projects she was working on. At 10:30, Susan dropped Richard off at his house. This was the last time she would be seen alive.
Susan's three dogs barked constantly throughout the night of December 22nd. The dogs tended to bark a lot, so the neighbors didn't think much of it initially. But on the following morning, when the dogs were seen running free throughout the neighborhood, the neighbors knew that something was amiss. It wasn't like Susan to leave her dogs unattended. And it certainly wasn't like Susan to leave her back door open. So on Christmas Eve, Susan's neighbors called the LAPD to request a welfare check. When police arrived at 1527 Benedict Canyon Drive, they found the front door unlocked and the back door ajar. They followed bloody paw prints from the back door to a back bedroom, where Susan's body was found. She was laying on her back, dressed in sweats and a t-shirt, and had been shot once in the back of the head with a 9mm bullet. Her body had laid there, on the floor of her guest room, for at least a day.
News of Susan's murder shocked and devastated her friends and colleagues. In the end, her death had been as strange and as unconventional as her life. In her New York Magazine piece about Susan Berman, titled, quote, "Who Killed the Gangster's Daughter?", author Lisa DiPaolo remarked that had Susan been alive to read about the circumstances of her own murder, she would have been fascinated by it. This was the kind of story Susan herself would have been obsessed with. Susan Berman lived a life marked by stark contrasts. She was born into wealth and died in poverty. She had known great success and great failure. She was passionate and full of love for her friends and family, yet crippled by depression and anxiety. She was charismatic and caring, yet manipulative and demanding. She placed a high value on her friendships and worked hard to stay connected with her friends, yet she could also be exhausting to them.
And Susan was nothing if not unique, in part because of the many fears and phobias that plagued her throughout her life. She was afraid of driving across bridges, riding in elevators, falling out of windows, and triggering one of her countless food allergies, among other things. But even with all her phobias and eccentricities, her ups and downs, Susan was adored by her friends and her children. And by the end of her life, she had become well-known among the literary and journalistic communities on both coasts. She seemed to leave an impression on any and all who met her.
Police theorized that Susan had been killed either on the night of Friday, December 22nd, after dropping her friend Richard off at his home, or on the morning of Saturday the 23rd. When they arrived on Sunday the 24th, officers noticed that Susan had never brought in the mail from the previous day. Susan's neighbors on both sides were consistent in their observation of the dogs barking throughout the night of the 22nd and running free in the neighborhood on the morning of the 23rd. So that sets up a window in which Susan's murder likely took place. Between 10:30 p.m. on the night of the 22nd, when Susan was last seen by her friend Richard, and the morning of the 23rd, when her dogs were seen in the neighborhood. Susan had been shot with a 9mm handgun in the back of the head at close range, execution style. Her home showed no signs of forced entry, no signs of a struggle, and nothing had been taken. The police found Susan's purse on the kitchen counter untouched, right where she had left it. Susan was a very paranoid person. This isn't a surprise, knowing her upbringing, and that she grew up under the ever-present threat of violence. Friends say that Susan would never open her door to a stranger. Susan had almost certainly known her killer. If police found the front door unlocked and the back door ajar, that means that Susan opened the front door to her killer and she closed it behind them. After killing Susan, the killer must have exited through the back door.
Soon after Susan's body was discovered, police received a note in the mail. The envelope was addressed to the Beverly Hills Police, and inside the note read, 1527 Benedict Canyon, cadaver. Both the address and the note had been written in slanting block letters. A couple of things stood out about this note. First, that Beverly had been spelled incorrectly, with an L-E-Y at the end instead of an L-Y. And second, that the author of the note had used the word cadaver instead of dead body or corpse. Cadaver is the medical term, of course, so the author must have had some knowledge of medicine or some exposure to medicine. And the author had likely written the letter, often referred to as the cadaver note, because they wanted Susan's body to be found. The LAPD considered several theories, motives, and suspects for Susan Berman's murder. First, could Susan's murder have been a mob hit? Was she going to reveal something in one of her upcoming projects that some gangster didn't want made public? Although Susan's murder had the look of a mob hit, this seems highly unlikely. Susan's interest in organized crime centered on her father's days in the Las Vegas mob in the 1950s. And 50 years later, most of Davy Berman's former associates were dead. And Susan hadn't exactly been critical of her father's associates in her work. These were the men that played cards with her when she was a little girl. She thought they were her uncles. If anything, she portrayed them with fondness. And furthermore, Susan's going to remain loyal to anyone who was loyal to her father. That's the code of conduct they all live by. So Susan wouldn't have wanted to send any of these aging gangsters to prison. What motive would they have had to kill her?
Police also investigated Dee Baskin Schiffer, Susan's landlady at 1527 Benedict Canyon Drive. For years, Susan and her elderly landlady had been in conflict. Susan complained that Dee would show up at her house unannounced to complain about Susan's dogs, unfinished repairs, and unpaid rent. For 3 years, Dee had threatened to evict Susan. And Susan told friends that she was afraid of Dee. She knew Dee owned a gun, and she was afraid the woman would harm her dogs. But it appears that in the days before Susan's murder, the dispute was finally resolved. Susan used the money from Robert Durst to pay her rent forward through March, and she made an agreement with her landlady to vacate the property in June. So the landlady did it seems like another unlikely theory. We've heard Susan's side of the story, and that she was afraid of the dispute becoming violent. But we also know that Susan was a very nervous, paranoid person. So maybe the situation wasn't as volatile and dangerous as Susan thought it was. More importantly, if you're the landlady and you have finally resolved this years-long dispute with Susan and you've both agreed that she'll vacate the property in 6 months' time, why kill Susan now?
Also on the LAPD's list of suspects was Susan's manager, Niall Brenner. Susan and Niall had a very bizarre and fraught relationship. We don't have a manager, so what do we know? But I think we can say that this went beyond the typical manager-client relationship. Susan called Niall multiple times a day to help deal with her fears and anxiety. Niall also drove Susan to the vet, the doctor's office, and the supermarket whenever she had to run errands. And Niall loaned Susan, his employer, money sometimes. Whenever Niall got tired of doing all of this for Susan, maybe he thought it was menial and unbefitting of a manager, Susan would say, okay, then leave. At which point, Niall would come back, begging for Susan's forgiveness, and they do it all again. Why, we don't really know. Susan's friends said that they thought Susan was in love with Niall, and a bit obsessed with him. Susan definitely drove Niall crazy with her behavior, but that still doesn't seem like motive. However, Niall did behave strangely after Susan's murder. The two were supposed to spend Christmas Eve together. Susan had made plans to spend that evening at an old school friend's house in Los Angeles, which was a tradition they had. This year, though, Susan would be bringing Niall with her. So when Christmas Eve rolled around, Niall drove to Susan's house. The police had already removed Susan's body and locked the doors to the house, but apparently they hadn't put up any tape or done anything else to secure the crime scene, because when no one answered the door, Niall crawled in through a back window. Niall apparently saw the fingerprint dust, but didn't notice anything else amiss in the house, despite there apparently being hair and blood left behind on the floor. When he went to ask the neighbors what had happened next door, they told him that Susan had died. He called all of Susan's friends then to notify them. At some point after Susan's death, Niall also reportedly went through Susan's voicemails and picked up her mail from her home. At Susan's funeral, several of Susan's friends reported having unsettling conversations with Niall. He said that now that Susan was dead, quote, at least I won't have someone calling me 3 times a day. Susan had, quote, sucked him dry. So yes, Niall did behave strangely after Susan's murder, and he did say some insensitive things at her funeral. But I don't think he's suspicious. I think he's just a weird dude. Susan managed to find a manager who was as odd as she was. And when LAPD analyzed the cadaver note received by police after Susan's murder, they compared it to samples of Niall Brenner's handwriting. And they concluded that Brenner was probably not the author of the cadaver note.
So the prevailing theory of Susan's murder, the one that is being presented at trial 20 years later, is that Susan was killed by her friend Robert Durst. Faced with the reopening of the Kathleen Durst case, and with the possibility that Susan would speak to police about his involvement in his wife's disappearance, Robert Durst silenced his friend Susan Berman. Shortly before Susan's murder, the Westchester County DA's office reopened the investigation into the 1982 disappearance of Kathleen Durst. At the time of her murder, Susan Berman was on a short list of people set to be interviewed by then Westchester County District Attorney Jeanine Pirro. Susan could have provided a wealth of information to the investigation. She was Robert Durst's close friend and confidant throughout their lives, and she had served as Bob's spokesperson after Kathleen Durst's disappearance. And as Susan herself had admitted to friends, she had perhaps helped Bob with his alibi, or even made that phone call to Albert Einstein Medical College pretending to be Kathy. But unfortunately, Susan was murdered right before the Westchester County authorities were set to speak with her. For the LAPD, this was and still is too strange of a coincidence. When confronted with this connection between the Westchester DA's investigation and Susan's murder, Robert Durst sort of tries to downplay it. He says that before her murder, Susan called him and actually warned him that the Westchester County DA wanted to speak with her, Susan. And Robert told Susan, well, she's welcome to talk to the DA. That was fine with him. No problem. In fact, the DA had not yet reached out to Susan. So either Susan lied with the intention of pressuring Bobby, or Bobby invented this conversation to show that even if Susan was trying to pressure him for money, he had nothing to hide and therefore no reason to kill her. It's hard to know what to make of this conversation.
But as usual, Robert Durst has a bit of a hard time getting his story straight. Durst first said that he was in the Hamptons with his second wife, Deborah Lee Cheriton, at the time of Susan's murder. When questioned later, Cheriton said that she and Durst hadn't actually spent that Christmas together, and that she didn't know where Durst had spent the holidays. But Durst's lawyer told police that on Christmas Eve day, Durst was on a plane from San Francisco to New York City. Now, this turned out to be true. Durst was on a red-eye flight that left San Francisco on the night of the 23rd and arrived in New York on the morning of the 24th. But we know that by Christmas Eve, Susan Berman had been dead for at least a day. So rather than providing Durst with an alibi, this puts him in California at the time of Susan's murder. Susan had also told several people that she expected a visit from her friend Bobby during the holidays. But just like the Kathleen Durst case, the Susan Berman case went cold. There wouldn't be any further breaks in the case until 2015, when HBO released a documentary series called The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst.
The Jinx premiered on HBO in February 2015. The series came about because of a film released in 2010 called All Good Things, which was a fictionalized adaptation of Robert Durst's life. Robert Durst himself read the screenplay for All Good Things shortly before the film was released and thought it was pretty good. He thought it represented the events of his life more or less accurately. So he got in touch with the filmmakers, Andrew Jarecki and Mark Smerling. Durst suggested that they record some interviews and commentary to be released along with All Good Things. Those interviews, filmed from 2010 to 2012, would later form the backbone of the Jinx, also produced by Jarecki and Smerling. Over 6 episodes, the Jinx chronicles the life of Robert Durst, from his childhood marked by tragedy, to his marriage to Kathy and her disappearance, to his strained relationship with the Durst family, to the murder of Susan Berman, to his life in Galveston, and the events that culminated in his dismemberment of Morris Black. If you weren't already familiar with the story of Robert Durst, and you just said to yourself, wait, what? He dismembered someone? We're not going to get into that here. Just go watch The Jinx if you want to know what the hell that was about. Anyways, Durst was a very willing participant in The Jinx. As we said before, the interviews that formed the basis of the series were filmed on his suggestion. The filmmakers were able to cultivate a rapport and a trust with Durst over several years. And as a result, Durst spoke very candidly in The Jinx about the many problematic things that he's admitted to doing. That he was physically abusive to his wife Kathy, that he lied about his actions on the night of his wife's disappearance to throw New York police off his trail, that he decapitated Morris Black in Galveston, that he went on the run several times to evade police.
However, something happened in the filmmaker's final interview with Robert Durst that Durst did not expect. The filmmakers pressed Durst on the issue of Susan Berman's murder and confronted him with something that he wasn't prepared to explain. In the middle of this final taped interview, conducted in April 2012, the filmmakers showed Robert Durst 2 letters. One was the so-called cadaver note sent to Los Angeles police after Susan's murder, which, as you remember, had the misspelling of Beverly on the envelope. The other letter was one sent to Susan Berman by Robert Durst in 1999. Both envelopes were addressed in the same slanted block letters, with the same misspelling of Beverly in the address. Faced with the obvious, troubling similarities in handwriting and spelling between the cadaver note and the letter he wrote, Durst is uncomfortable. You can see in his body language that he does not want to be there anymore. And he didn't even know that the filmmakers had these letters. They had obtained a copy of the cadaver note from the LAPD, and Susan's son, Sarab Kaufman, had given them the 1999 letter, which is why you'll sometimes see this letter referred to as the Sarab letter. So, in a bind, Durst acknowledged the similarities between the 2 letters, and he said he wrote the Sarab letter, but not the cadaver note. But when shown just the 2 spellings of Beverly, sort of spliced from the 2 envelopes and placed side by side on another piece of paper, Durst couldn't say which Beverly he had written and which one he had not written.
Durst, the filmmakers, and we, the audience, are confronted with the irrefutable reality. You can feel all the energy just getting sucked out of the room, because anyone with eyes can see that Robert Durst wrote the cadaver note, that he wrote it after killing his friend Susan Berman because he wanted her body to be found. So the interview concludes at this point, and Durst gets up to use the restroom. He goes into the restroom, and he does not realize that his microphone is still on, and he begins talking to himself, which he's wont to do. So this stream of consciousness lasts for several minutes, but we can clearly discern that Durst says, okay, and when you watch this movie, he has a very characteristic speaking style. He has a raspy voice, and he has a very unique way of speaking. So I'm not even going to try to replicate it. And also he's like wheezing and burping and stuff. So I'm just going to say it in my own voice. So he has a stream of consciousness for several minutes. And then we hear him say, there it is. You're caught. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. And on that bizarre and chilling note, the series ends.
It's really one of the spookiest moments of television. Yes. I've ever seen it. Really, yes. It just leaves you feeling cold and scared.
I remember we looked at each other and it was like, what just happened?
It's epic. If nothing else, go watch that last episode. So in April 2012, around the time that the makers of The Jinx were filming that final faded interview with Robert Durst, something happened in the Susan Berman case. Unbeknownst to the filmmakers and to Robert Durst, Los Angeles detectives reopened the investigation into Susan Berman's murder after 12 years. Detectives worked to build their case until March 2015, when they obtained an arrest warrant for Robert Durst. When they arrived at Durst's home in Houston to arrest him, he wasn't there. Robert Durst was on the run again, I think for the third time. Classic Robert. Several days later, Durst was arrested at a hotel in New Orleans, coincidentally one day before the final episode of The Jinx aired on HBO.
Now, fast forward 5 years to March 4th, 2020. It's the first day of Robert Durst's trial for the murder of Susan Berman. In the 8+ years since the interviews for The Jinx were filmed, Durst has aged a lot. He's now a frail 77-year-old who uses hearing aids, who needs physical assistance to enter and exit the courtroom, who has undergone treatment for esophageal cancer, and who has a visibly protuberant spot on his skull where a shunt was installed in his brain. Durst has changed in those 8+ years, and so has his case. Since the 2012 interview for The Jinx, in which he was confronted with the similarities between his 1999 letter to Susan and the cadaver note sent to Los Angeles police, Durst has admitted that he wrote the cadaver note. But Durst's lawyers argue that he didn't kill Susan Berman, and he doesn't know who did. The prosecution's case is extensive and ambitious. They're attempting to weave Durst's three alleged murders of his wife Kathleen Durst, his neighbor Morris Black, and his close friend Susan Berman into a narrative that explains why he would have killed Susan without allowing Susan's murder to be overshadowed by Durst's other alleged victims. It's a delicate balance. And because the most incriminating evidence against Robert Durst comes from Durst himself, the prosecutors will be introducing the interview footage from The Jinx as evidence, along with the audio commentary Durst recorded for the film All Good Things and All Good Things itself. The trial began in March of this year with the prosecution's opening statement. After that, the defense presented their opening statement. But the jury was only able to hear 1 or 2 days of testimony before the trial was suspended due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The judge and both the prosecution and defense teams later agreed that the trial would be adjourned until April 2021.
When the judge, jury, prosecutors, and defense attorneys return to the courtroom next April, it will have been more than a year since the jury heard both sides' opening statements. Robert Durst will be a year older and a year frailer. If and when the trial continues, we can only hope that Durst will have a fair trial, and that more than 20 years after her death, Susan Berman and her loved ones will finally have justice. It did occur to us on Christmas this year that it was 20 years since Christmas of 2000 when Susan died, so it's been a long time. Before we finish, we'd like to leave you with two final things that we came across in our reading about this case. The first is a note that Susan Berman wrote to her friend Bobby Durst in November of 2000. This note was in response to the $25,000 check that Susan had received as a gift from Durst. In her note, Susan writes, "Dearest Bobby, I don't want my last request to be the last time we communicate. Our friendship means so much to me, Bobby. I hope you forgive me for not keeping pace with your more successful life." And the second is a story told by Nick Chavin, a friend of both Susan Berman and Robert Durst, about a dinner Chavin had with Durst in December of 2014. Prior to the dinner, Durst told Chavin that he wanted to talk about Kathy and Susan. So Chavin and Durst get to the restaurant, they have dinner, and the dinner ends without any mention of Kathy or Susan. On their way out of the restaurant, Chavin asked Durst, "So, you wanted to talk about Susan?" And Durst replied, "I had to. It was either her or me. I had no choice."
So, now that we've finished our dive into the murder of Susan Berman, we'd like to close with a segment we're calling CCS Recommends, where we'll each be sharing with you a movie, book, podcast, recipe, artist, or other cool thing that we're enjoying at the moment.
So my recommendation for this episode is another audiovisual thing. It's a travel/food show called Somebody Feed Phil. And it follows Phil Rosenthal, who you may know as the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, as he eats his way around the world, visiting different food destinations around the world with the help of friends and family. And if you want to know what Phil is like as a host, just picture Anthony Bourdain if he were a lanky, pale, very earnest, and very socially awkward New York Jew. So nothing like Anthony Bourdain, who we love, R.I.P., but great in his own way. And this show is like comfort food, and not just because it's a food show, but just because watching an episode makes you feel better about the world. It's cheesy, but it's true. Phil manages to make friends everywhere, regardless of language or age or background, and he has this really warm, generous spirit that is contagious. And at the end of every show, Phil Skypes with his adorable, elderly Jewish parents back in New York and shares some of the highlights from his trip. So that's the level of wholesomeness that we're talking about here. And since traveling isn't safe or possible for many people at the moment, it's all the more reason to travel virtually from the comfort or discomfort of your quarantine home. So again, the name of the show is Somebody Feed Phil, and you can check it out on Netflix. The fourth season recently premiered, so you should have enough episodes to get you through the rest of this crappy pandemic winter.
All right, So my recommendation is very different from my podcast partner. Like, hers is kind of the palate cleanser from true crime. My recommendation was a gift from my podcast partner. And it is a book entitled Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. And it was named by the New York Times Book Review as one of the 10 best books of 2019, and I can absolutely attest to how great a read it is. It's a murder mystery at heart, but woven into the telling is a very accessible, understandable, digestible examination of the period in Northern Ireland's history known as the Troubles. The author of the book is Patrick Radden Keefe, and if that name sounds familiar, and maybe it is to you if you listen to a lot of podcasts, he's also the host of a really great podcast that we loved called Wind of Change. Mm-hmm. So I recommend that podcast as well.
So thanks for tuning in to another episode of California Crime Stories. If you have any questions or feedback for us, or if you want to suggest a case that you think we should cover in a future episode, send us an email at feedback@ccspod.com. That's feedback@ccspod.com. We hope to have a Twitter up and running soon where we'll be posting some photos and letting you know about upcoming episodes. California Crime Stories is researched, written, and produced by us, your hosts, with artwork also provided by us. Our theme is Arcadia by Cody Merton. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.